Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Senator Elizabeth Warren's deep opposition to the 21st Century Cures Act.
Congress should not be in the business of selling FDA favors to the highest bidders, risking people's lives to enrich political donors.
But the Massachusetts biotech sector wants Warren to reconsider, saying the multi-billion dollar bill will push medical research forward. Also today, in another landmark biotech story, we'll take a look at a major patent case that could redefine who owns new gene editing technology. Plus, at Salem State, students demanded a provocative work of art be taken down.
They need to understand that intention does not negate consequence, and it does not negate what I or my peers personally felt when we walked in and saw that image.
So what did the university decide to do? That's all next on Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A little later this afternoon, the U.S. Senate is set to vote on whether to end debate over a massive 900-page bill aimed at modernizing medical research. Of course, Massachusetts has large biotech, pharma, medical devices, and basic research sectors, so the bill matters a lot around here. But maybe you hadn't heard of it until, say, a week ago. That's when Senator Elizabeth Warren stood on the Senate floor and thundered against the legislation.
In the closing days of this Congress, Big Pharma has its hand out for a bunch of special giveaways and favors that are packed together in something called the 21st Century Cures Bill.
Well, in fact, Warren herself worked on the 21st Century Cures Bill for the past 2 years. She even wrote parts of the $6.3 billion legislation. But when the latest version of the bill was quietly released by Republicans over Thanksgiving weekend, Warren was outraged.
A bill that is supposed to be about medical innovation has a giveaway to the gun lobby. The bill cuts Medicare funding. It raids money from the Affordable Care Act. It takes health care dollars that should have gone to Puerto Rico. It makes it harder for people with disabilities to get Medicaid services. There is a lot of bad stuff in this bill. And when the American voters say that Congress is owned by big companies, this bill is exactly what they're talking about.
That's Senator Elizabeth Warren on the Senate floor a week ago today. So we've got kind of an interesting situation here. A popular Massachusetts senator is objecting passionately to parts of a major bill that could be a significant boon to Massachusetts. She says she supports scientists and research, but not the big industries that could also benefit. And she's getting passionate pushback from those very same scientists and researchers. In a moment, we'll talk with one of those people. But first, let's get some more details about exactly what's in the 21st Century Cures Act. So joining us now is Victoria McGrain. She's national political correspondent for the Boston Globe, and she joins us on the line from Washington. Welcome to the show, Victoria.
Hi, glad to be here.
So first of all, this is a 900-page bill. There is a lot in it. How long and how involved has Senator Warren been in the 21st Century Cures Act up until now?
Well, as you said, she's a member of the Health and Education and Labor Committee in the Senate, that where a lot of this work was done. So she was very involved. Her big push was to get that funding for the National Institutes of Health, the medical research funding in there, to complement what the Republicans were pushing for, which is changes to the process done by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, trying to speed up the review process for drugs and medical devices.
Yeah, so we'll talk more about those two things, the NIH funding and changes in sort of FDA oversight in just a second. But that sort of leads us to really what's at issue here is that this bill is huge. It has something for everyone. It was receiving lots of bipartisan support. At what point in time, though, did Warren, even though she says she supports a lot of it, feel so strongly that she had to come out against it? When did that change?
Well, she had a colleague of mine had wrote a story back when the original version of the bill was passing in the Senate, and you saw Elizabeth Warren raising some concerns. But what really changed was that there had been these closed door negotiations going on between Democrats and Republicans trying to get a bill that could pass both the House and the Senate. And that bill was released the Friday after Thanksgiving when nobody's paying any attention, and it suddenly looked a lot different than what Democrats who were not as part of that small inside group were expecting. And so that's why we saw Elizabeth Warren take to the floor a week ago, because the latest version had just been unveiled a few days before.
I see. So just again, we're going to get into the details in more detail. Sorry, we're going to get into details more a little bit with the next person we'll talk with. But I just did want to ask you, Victoria, what does our state's other senator, Senator Ed Markey, have to say about this? Because the bill also includes, what, $1 billion in funding for opioid addiction treatment and research?
Yes. So Senator Markey, the last I've heard from his office, and I was that he is still deciding what to do. He has been pushing very hard for that opioid money. And, you know, this bill in a lot of ways is sort of, artfully designed to put Democrats in this tough position of including these good things that they've been working on, but has some things that they would not like to support. We'll see what happens tonight.
Mm. And now I see that Governor Charlie Baker has actually spoken out about this as well. What's his position on it?
He put out a statement, interestingly, at the urging of the Obama administration. So the Obama administration is publicly on record supporting this, has been lobbying people on Capitol Hill to vote for it, despite their concerns. It's an interest. You know, it's sort of a classic Washington conundrum. You just saw that Elizabeth Warren would not disagree with any of the same things, you know, that Charlie Baker or the Obama administration says are good. She's just saying it's coming at too high of a cost. The trade-offs are not worth, you know, the promises of future funding. That money is not guaranteed. That research money and that. You know, the trade-off isn't worth it is kind of the crux of her argument.
Right. Now, the bill did pass the House last week, right?
Yes.
And it passed what? Overwhelmingly, I'm seeing something like
overwhelmingly. I think there were 26 no votes. Some of those were very conservative Republicans who I think were objecting to the spending of money, and then some more Democrats who had shared Elizabeth Warren's concerns about the trade-offs in the bill. But yes, overwhelmingly supported bipartisan bill, which you do not see around here that often these days.
Right. And they're taking a cloture vote in the Senate. So for those of us who don't really remember Robert's Rules of Order here, remind us what the cloture vote is all about.
That means to end debate needs 60 votes. So this is when people talk about a filibuster, for the Senate to formally move on to voting on the actual bill itself. 60 senators need to say, okay, we're ready to end debate on this bill and move forward. So it's kind of a higher threshold than your 51 majority.
Mm-hmm.
And then that would set up a vote, I believe, for tomorrow to vote on the bill itself.
And is it looking likely to pass the Senate?
Yes, I believe so. I haven't seen any sort of hard numbers, but you know, the clock is ticking, and only a handful of Democrats have come out to even really harshly criticize the bill publicly. What my sources tell me is, you know, privately, a lot of Democrats are are concerned about the funding issue, the fact that this money isn't guaranteed to ever show up. It's, you know, the Senate in future years will have to vote and say, okay, we're actually going to spend this research money that we say we're going to, but that, you know, they don't have any leverage to make it better, that this is the best bill, that this is the bill that's there, and they don't feel like it's worth voting against it.
Right. Well, Victoria McGrane is national political correspondent for the Boston Globe, bringing us up to date on the politics behind the controversy that's currently surrounding the 21st Century Cures Act. Victoria, thank you so much.
Sure. Glad to be here.
Well, I should say that we also put out a request to speak with Senator Elizabeth Warren today. Her office said she wasn't available to talk with us today. But we do have what she said on the floor of the Senate, and we're going to be hearing a little bit more of that in a moment. Now, biotech research and development are big parts of the economy in Massachusetts, which is why members in those sectors have been calling on Senator Warren to change her views and support the 21st Century Cures Act. So joining us now is Robert Coughlin. He's president and CEO of the Massachusetts Biotechnology Council. He joins us to talk about the effect he believes that this bill could have on Massachusetts. Robert Coughlin, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, I mean, what's your primary message to Elizabeth Warren? What are we at risk here with her opposition to the 21st Century Cures Act?
Well, there's a lot at risk, not only for the economy here in Massachusetts, but for patients of the world. Massachusetts is in the business of innovation and drug discovery. We're the best place in the world for this business, and 21st Century Cures will enable us to continue to lead the way and do better. And we think it's important that she supports it.
Mm. Well, so let's get to the details here, because it is a massive bill, more than $6 billion on the line with this legislation. And the senator has said she's very supportive of key parts of the legislation, but she came to oppose it. One of the reasons was that most of the $4.8 billion in funding that initially had been guaranteed to the National Institutes of Health in an earlier House version has suddenly been turned into discretionary spending. I mean, in other words, that money is going to be released in future years only if Congress votes to do so, to give it to the NIH. And she doesn't actually think that's likely to happen, since Congress has already reduced funding for medical research in previous years. So Robert Coughlin, stand by with us, because I want to hear a little bit more of what Senator Warren had to say about NIH funding last week on the Senate floor.
Adjusted for inflation, federal spending on medical research over the past dozen years has been cut by 20%. Those cuts take the legs out from under future medical innovation in America. You know, we can name a piece of legislation a cures bill, but if it doesn't include significant, meaningful funding for the National Institutes of Health and the Food and Drug Administration, it won't cure anything.
Robert Coughlin, respond to that, because doesn't she have a point here? I mean, if it's up to Congress to renew this discretionary spending, it's not a guaranteed sum of money. It's not a guaranteed revenue stream for future research for Massachusetts companies.
Well, you could argue that at least to have the ability to have discretionary funding, there's a step in the right direction. It's better than not having any. You know, the American people clearly are upset because of inaction in Washington, D.C., and with the 21st Century Cures Act, has gone through years of deliberation. And, you know, you could argue as well, by the time consensus is built around any issue, there will most likely be something in it that you may not agree with. But you need to ask yourself, does the good in this bill outweigh what you may disagree with? And for Massachusetts and for patients, the good far outweighs what Senator Warren thinks is not good in the 21st Century Cures Act.
Hmm. Well, so let's take another look at sort of another part of what she thinks is not good. Because, again, I take your point that it's the sum of these things that
Absolutely.
People have to balance out.
Absolutely.
So she also talked about a provision in the act that she says would loosen FDA authority, because this new version of the bill, it includes cuts to Medicare and also these rules that would allow drug makers to market some products to treat conditions that were actually not part of their initial FDA approval. And she calls it, quote, legalizing fraud. That's Senator Warren's word. And basically she says that this provision in the act is a workaround around current law that restricts companies from marketing drugs that have only been approved by the FDA for specific uses. So here's what she said.
Now, some drug companies find this rule annoying. After all, they could make a lot more money selling a headache pill as a cure for everything from hair loss to cancer. But pushing treatments without scientific evidence that they work is fraud that can hurt people.
again, Robert Coughlin, on this specific point, isn't she making sort of a powerful argument here? It is loosening FDA oversight, is it not?
No, it's a horrible argument, and fraud is a terrible word to use when people are dying. I mean, this would permit the FDA to consider real-world evidence to supplement data from clinical trials and drug safety monitoring. It's not going to reduce the FDA's high standards for safety and efficacy. What it will do is expedite the time it takes to invent a drug. If an existing compound that we know is safe could work for a different disease or indication, isn't that a good thing? I came to this industry because I have a child, a 14-year-old son, that has cystic fibrosis. There isn't a treatment available to him today. Wouldn't it be good to know that if there were drugs that were on the market for other diseases would work in cystic fibrosis, we could get that to my son before he dies? That's what this is about. It's not about fraud. It's about expediting the drug discovery and approval process so that we can not only save lives, but reduce the overall cost to healthcare by making people well.
You're not concerned that it could potentially cost lives? Because, I mean, you say real-world evidence, and I'm seeing that as a sort of part of the language around this bill, but that's not the same standard as those drugs that have gone all the way through clinical trial for specific diseases.
When my son was born 14 years ago, I thought that there would be drugs that work for him, and there still isn't. We're running out of time. When you talk about risk to benefit ratio as it relates to somebody who's dying, a loved one that's passing away, I mean, the risk is worth it. It's about sacrificing efficacy. And if it's real world evidence, the drug is already proved to be sacrificing safety, rather. It's already proven to be safe in people elsewhere.
So on that point, Robert Coughlin, let me just present one more of Senator Warren's arguments to you, because I really appreciate hearing your response on this. Because
okay,
one of her underlying critiques here is she sees the bill as having morphed into a bunch of, in her words, sort of government giveaways to big companies. And here's some context. I just want to present this to the listeners. We've seen reporting that, you know, some 1,400 lobbyists acting on behalf of more than 400 companies have lobbied about this bill. And the companies who disclose that they've lobbied on the Cures Act, they say they've spent $500 million to influence Congress. And Senator Warren sort of focused on what she says is one particular outcome of all this lobbying that we see in the bill. And that is, there's a part of the bill that would move to speed up the delivery of cellular and regenerative therapies, so adult stem cell therapies, and that those therapies could go to patients. Those therapies could go to market before they're definitively proved to be safe and effective. So here is what Senator Warren said about that.
It delivers a special deal so that people can sell these treatments without meeting the FDA gold standards for protecting patient safety and making sure that these drugs actually do some good. You know, keep in mind, people could die from using unproven treatments.
Now, Robert Coughlin, in this case, regarding these particular therapies, Senator Warren says that the bill would allow them to go to market even before they've gone through effective safety testing.
Well, I find it hard to believe that the FDA would be approving anything that wasn't proven safe. And first and foremost, you have to realize that people are dying if they don't receive therapies anyway. So again, what is the risk to benefit ratio? We're looking at moving forward as it relates to regenerative medicine, precision medicine. What's next as it relates to these breakthrough therapies? And this bill provides the opportunity for companies to do that. In Massachusetts, we have over 800 smaller companies that are doing research and development right now in these areas, and this bill will enable them to be more successful. It's a good bill for Massachusetts, and it's a good bill for the patients of the world.
I've seen people talk about how the fact that this 21st Century Cures Act, people see the best of Washington bound up in it and also the worst of Washington bound up in it. Is that your view here? And I mean, I guess you kind of said that you really don't think we can get anything better out of it right now.
Yeah, well, let's at least get something. Let's see some action down in Washington, D.C. All of our members of Congress, the House of Representatives, voted in favor of this bill. All of them. They see, and I'm sure by the time there is concurrence on any legislation, whether it's here in Massachusetts or down in Washington, D.C. There's always going to be something in there that you may not think is perfect, and you know, you can't let perfect be the enemy of the good. And in this situation, I would argue that Senator Warren agrees with a lot more in that bill, and if there's just a couple of pieces that you don't disagree with, let's try to fix that later. But let's not throw everything out because of a couple of pieces that you may not agree with.
Well, Robert Coughlin is president and CEO of the Massachusetts Biotechnology Council, a group that represents more than 700 biotech companies, academic institutions, and other organizations. We're going to be digging more deeply into specifics of the bill later on this week because it's big, it's complicated, and it matters a lot here. So, Robert Coughlin, thank you so very much for helping us get this conversation started.
Thanks for having me.
More than 125 people are trying to piece their lives back together after a massive 10-alarm fire tore through their Cambridge neighborhood on Saturday. The fire began around 3 o'clock and damaged some 16 structures. There were no fatalities or serious injuries reported, thank goodness, but officials are still investigating the cause, and they say there's no evidence that the fire was set intentionally. Dana Fuller lived next to the house where the fire is believed to have started. His family owned the house on Berkshire Street, his house, since 1930, and he spoke to us earlier this afternoon on his cell phone. Fuller says he was actually having a quiet Saturday afternoon, and then the fire broke out.
Yes, I was on my couch watching TV, and the doorbell rang, and the house next to us had been being renovated. At this point, it was totally gutted, and the doorbell rings, and I don't recognize the person. I buzz him in, what's going on? He says, hey, the house next door is on fire. So I'm like, what? So I run downstairs and, you know, just wearing a T-shirt and some sweatpants. And I run downstairs and I look outside and the house next door that they were working on, the first floor of the house next door is engulfed in flames. So this guy who rang my bell, he takes off running down the street and I yell at him, did you call 911? And he's like, yeah, but I don't hear any sirens. So I call 911 to make sure. So within a matter of 2 minutes, the whole neighborhood, I mean, 3, 4, 5 homes at least were on fire. The flames had shot across the street. So, you know, I'm frantically panicking, calling 911, you get here. And, you know, within a minute, my house was on fire. The houses across the street were on fire. And, I mean, just if this would have happened at night, I mean, the good things to take away from this, nobody got hurt. If this would have happened in the middle of the night and not the middle of the afternoon, the way everything went up and the speed with which everything ignited, there wouldn't have been time for people to get out of their homes. So, you know, you take away the positive things. Hey, listen, you know, I lost every single last thing that I own, but that stuff can all be replaced.
Well, Dana Fuller says that even though he's got that good perspective on it, the last 48 hours have been a blur for him and his neighbors.
Still hasn't sunk in. I'm still in a state of shock. A shock when you're watching the whole neighborhood, you know, go up in flames like that. And, you know, it's property that, you know, your family, my mom grew up in that house. My great-grandfather bought them, you know, just under 100 years ago. So it's, you know, it still hasn't sunk in. They tore the house down. What was remaining of the house, they tore it down last night. So we went by the scene today, and it's just still a state of shock.
Well, as you heard Dana say even earlier, he and many of his neighbors have actually lost everything. But Dana is still trying to look for the positives.
It's great to see the way the communities come together and rallied around the people who, you know, lost everything that they have. It's just, you know, that's just so great to see that, you know, the Boston strong spirit that everybody's exhibiting with the mayor's fire relief fund and, you know, just all the well wishes and all the, you know, what can I do to help from all my friends and all the family and even from strangers in the neighborhood. That's a great positive to take away. At the end of the day, you got to stay positive in a situation like this. You know, getting down and feeling bad for yourself and why me and this and that, that's not productive to producing anything positive. You know, you got to stay positive and say, hey, listen, I'm alive. That could have been completely different. And everything that I lost, it's all, you know, possessions, you know, they can be replaced.
Dana Fuller, he's a resident of Berkshire Street. He survived this Saturday's 10-alarm blaze in Cambridge. Now, Cambridge City officials say for anyone who's looking to help, you can donate to the Cambridge Mayor's Relief Fund. We've got information about that at radioboston.org. Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. One of the biggest biotech battles of the century is heading to court. Three federal patent judges will hear oral argument tomorrow in a heated dispute over a gene editing technology known as CRISPR. With us now to tell us more is Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. Hello, Carrie.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay. So before we get to the legal battle, which is a big, huge, important one, let's first of all remind us, what exactly is CRISPR and why should we care?
Okay. So CRISPR is an acronym. Let me tell you compulsively that it stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats, but that doesn't matter. What matters is that CRISPR is a technology that makes it much, much easier to tweak genes in all kinds of useful ways. And it's really, it's widely hailed as really a major revolution in biology. It's been sweeping labs around the world just in the last 3 or 4 years or so, and it's already spawned a bunch of well-funded biotech companies that are aiming to use CRISPR to do everything from curing genetic diseases to making better crops.
Okay, so the analogy that I've heard most often used with CRISPR is that it acts something like molecular scissors to cut up bits of genome.
Yes, the scissors is often used, although my favorite analogy is that it's kind of like going from an old-style typewriter, for anyone who's old enough to remember that, where you had to use whiteout. It was a very laborious process to fix mistakes. So now this is more like a word processing program that lets you seek out the spots that you want to change, sort of like when you use, you know, Control F for find or Command F in a word processing program. And then you can change the things you need to change much more easily before. CRISPR is actually even called a gene editing tool.
Ah, so like a find and replace, right?
Exactly.
Gotcha. Okay.
Exactly.
So obviously valuable technology.
Very, very valuable. And the rights to that valuable technology are very disputed. And that's what this case coming before the patent court outside Washington, D.C. tomorrow is all about. So it's a really complicated case, but to reduce it to the simplest possible outlines, it's basically like an East Coast, West Coast dispute. And the East Coast element is here in Cambridge. It's the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, which is this big genomics juggernaut. You know, like it's a leading research center on gene science and DNA, and specifically the work done by one stellar young scientist, Feng Zhang.
Okay, and then the West Coast element?
And the West Coast element is Berkeley. It's the University of California at Berkeley, and the researcher there, the lead researcher, is Jennifer Doudna, who's also known as totally stellar. She's a major pioneer of CRISPR.
So this is like a biotech version of an East Coast, West Coast hip-hop battle.
Right, or a rap battle.
I don't mean to make light of it. I mean, obviously, this is a major, major issue, a serious thing, but I just couldn't help it. But the question before the patent judges is what? Basically, who invented CRISPR?
Well, actually, bacteria invented CRISPR.
Okay.
So they use it in nature as part of their defenses against viruses. And there's actually been work on CRISPR going back many years by many scientists, including even in the yogurt industry. So it's a long history. But the question before the patent court is ultimately, yes, you're right. Who gets the credit? Who gets the right to license CRISPR for all these promising new uses that are exploding?
Okay. And the reason why this matters is money, right? Because, it would be a licensing issue. Anytime someone uses CRISPR, they'd have to pay or something like that.
If you use it commercially, yeah.
I see.
Right.
But it's not as straightforward as looking to who filed the first patent on CRISPR?
Right. It's tricky because some of the, I don't want to get into the weeds, some of the filings were expedited or faster, some weren't. And the arguments tomorrow are part of what's called an interference, which is a process the U.S. Patent Office uses when more than one party claims to have invented the same thing. So the court will be trying to determine who invented this thing first, not who filed first.
I see. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the judges then, they could decide whether, you know, Cambridge and the East Coast wins, or whether Berkeley and the West Coast wins, or both? Could that be an outcome?
Could be one of those Solomonic decisions, or the sides could settle, although that seems unlikely. So I spoke with Professor Paul Gugliuzza. He's an expert on patent litigation at Boston University School of Law, and I asked him which side he would bet on if he were a betting man.
I would not bet on the outcome of this case. Determining who is the first to invent can be very difficult. It requires the judges to sort of sift through mountains of documentary evidence, like lab notebooks, the results of experimental tests, draft manuscripts from journal articles and other things like that.
So that's why I will also not be talking about the details of this case with you. And he also says that generally the judges consider testimony from the inventors and other witnesses. So because the whole thing depends so much on specific facts and details, the outcomes of a proceeding like this are notoriously unpredictable.
So young scientists out there listening, your lab notebooks are so important.
Keep those lab notebooks.
Right. Okay, well, let's back up a little here, Carrie, because I'm curious why this dispute has even come to this place, to a court of law to begin with.
Right. Well, and Guliotta says it's because, when a technology promises to be extraordinarily valuable, that's when you're likelier to get an interference case like this. He says the patent office gets about 500,000 patent applications a year, and it only declares about 50 interferences like this.
So what's so different then about this patent fight?
It's just there's so much at stake. It's so rare that a new technology is as buzzed about as CRISPR is, as celebrated, and the potential is looking huge. And, this case, it's clearly costing millions and millions in legal fees, but Guliotta pointed out that these interferences often are great big fights, and they can last years and years.
The case that I used to teach my students about interferences was a priority fight between Bristol-Myers Squibb and the University of Texas involving a method to identify cancer-fighting drugs, and it took 16 years for that interference to be resolved, and that's not unprecedented. Another famous interference involving a patent on polypropylene lasted 30 years.
So we might want to settle in for the long haul here, Meghna. And here's the weird little twist, that the outcome of this big fight does matter, of course, for what happens with CRISPR, but it's not going to be very relevant for future cases because the law has already changed. So for things that are invented today, the patent is no longer given to the first person to invent it, but to the first person to file a patent application, which is, of course, much easier to determine. So interference proceedings like tomorrow's are going to fade away within years, and that's probably a good thing.
First person to file, like, but not the first patent to be approved? I mean, oh, so many questions, so many legal details. Okay, I'm not going to get us distracted about with that. That's a future conversation. In the meantime, though, is this a huge fight? And is it taking away resources from either of these institutions that could actually be used for advancing science?
Right. It's a painful question. And, as much as we might relish watching a good fight, maybe it does seem unfortunate. I asked Guliotta about that.
Patents are all about striking a balance between providing incentives for innovation and also making sure that the technology is widely available. Right? So we want to make sure that those who invest in developing technology, as these universities undoubtedly have, are able to recoup their investment through exclusive rights for a limited duration. But one might certainly look at a dispute like this, where the parties have reportedly spent over $20 million in legal fees, and reasonably wonder if it's impeding rather than promoting the progress of science.
So, again, it's a painful question. It reminds me a little bit of the recent election where people are saying, wow, this doesn't usually get this ugly, But one nicer aspect is that although there's been some sniping back and forth, these leading scientists have really stayed above the fray. And I think that's a great thing. Like, I really want them just sticking to their lab benches and churning out their brilliant work.
But others are weighing in, though, right?
Others are weighing in, including here on Radio Boston back in April. Eric Lander, the head of the Broad Institute, was on. And though he wouldn't comment specifically on this patent case, but he did speak about a controversial piece that he wrote recently in the journal Cell that traced the history of CRISPR. And critics called out Lander. They said that he highlighted the role of Broad Institute biologist Feng Zhang and that he downplayed the contributions of the Berkeley biochemist Jennifer Doudna. Here's what he said on our air in April.
I thought it was really important to send the message that no scientific discovery is the work of any one or two or three scientists. It's usually the work of an entire community coming together over the course of decades.
Which is undeniably true, right, Meghna? Like, scientists all stand on the shoulders of the scientists that came before them, and more than ever, they work in teams, right?
Right. And I have to say, there are critics of Lander who say it's disingenuous to say that because potentially billions of dollars are on the line here.
Yes. So it is also undeniably true that the Broad Institute has a dog in this fight. In fact, it is a dog in this fight. So you know how they say history gets written by the victors, and the history of CRISPR is still being written. as we speak and as the patent office deliberates.
Well, we'll stay up to date on how those deliberations go with the help of Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. You can find a link to her post about the CRISPR patent battle, the East Coast, West Coast biotech throwdown, I'm going to call it.
I like it.
That link is at our website.